world of political philosophy, Harry Jaffa holds a special place. He is the best-known contemporary spokesman for the natural right and natural law principles of the Declaration of Independence. He is also a respected teacher and thinker, and was the first to do serious scholarship on the Lincoln-Douglas debates, taking a sympathetic view of Lincoln's position. His book on that subject, Crisis of the House Divided, is the hallmark of his many acclaimed writings, with topics ranging from the Bible to Mark Twain to Shakespeare to classical political philosophy. Born in New York City in 1918, Harry Jaffa grew up the son of a Greenwich Village nightclub owner. As a boy, he played the violin while excelling in school. In 1935, he entered Yale University, where he studied government and English literature. Upon graduation from Yale, he continued there for 2 more years of postgraduate work and eventually applied for a government job with the city of New York. In order to prepare for the qualifying examination, he enrolled in a course at the New School for Social Research, and it was there that he found the sort of intellectual environment he'd always craved but failed to discover at Yale. Taking more coursework at the New School, he eventually entered the PhD program, where he met Professor Leo Strauss in 1944. Their relationship was to change Jaffa's life. Strauss taught that there was a principal meaning and a philosophic basis for human freedom. Those ideas became central themes in Jaffa's writings and teaching. Throughout his career, he revived the study of statesmanship, which had been waning, and focused his attention on the great figures of history who helped to extend our understanding of the human condition and the institutions of a free society. After teaching at the University of Chicago and Ohio State University, in 1964, Jaffa joined the faculty of Claremont McKenna College and Claremont Graduate School in Claremont, California. There he is the Henry Salvatore Research Professor in Political Philosophy, emeritus in 1989, and a distinguished fellow with the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy. He recently released a sequel to his classic, Crisis of the House Divided, titled A New Birth of Freedom. Professor Jaffa is married to Marjorie Butler. They have 3 children, Donald, Philip, and Karen. At his home in Claremont, Professor Jaffa sat down to talk about his life and work with Edward J. Erler. Professor Erler is a former graduate student of Jaffa's and is now a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute and a professor of political science at California State University. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Professor Harry Jaffa.
You were an undergraduate literature major at Yale. Mm-hmm. What were those years like, and how did that influence your subsequent career in political philosophy?
Well, I'm not sure that there was any intellectual development during those early years. I was exposed to a lot of books, which I read and enjoyed. Maybe you can call that intellectual development. I know in my freshman year at Yale, I had 5 courses. Three of them were subjects that I had studied in high school, and in each case, the high school course was better than the Yale course. But the courses in English literature and in government were ones that I liked. And in the spring of 1936, when I had to make out my program, and I was asked what I might major in, and I said, well, it would be either English or government, but whichever one I chose, I would study the other one in graduate school. I was then asked what I would expect to do as a result of studying something in graduate school, and I didn't really know, but I thought, well, I guess I'll teach. And my freshman advisor at Yale said, well, you can't teach in college. And I said, why not? Because you're Jewish. So I was confronted with the fact that my vocational ambition, as it was developing, was something that I was told that I couldn't do.
Leo Strauss has had a profound effect upon your career. How did you meet Leo Strauss?
Well, I met him when I walked into his classroom in the fall of 1944. I had taken a series of courses at the New School. I should mention that I left Yale in the spring of 1940. And I think I made a good decision in going to Yale when I did, and I made an equally good decision in leaving Yale when I did. I had spent a year as a graduate student in government, but I was completely disillusioned with the course there. And I could have stayed and got my PhD at Yale if I'd wanted to, but I just saw that there was nothing there that I wanted to learn. In the fall of 44, I just looked at what courses were available, and there was a course in political theory by Leo Strauss. And so I just walked into the classroom, and I had met my destiny. So I had no idea. In fact, it was some time before I knew from the outset that this was an extraordinary man and an extraordinary teacher, and he made political philosophy extraordinarily interesting. But I didn't realize he was reversing, you might say, well, not things I had learned at Yale, but the assumptions underlying the Yale education, which were the assumptions of what we later would come to call historicism, which meant that the thought of any person is ultimately determined by the age in which he lives and by the assumptions of the society in which he lives. And these assumptions of which, many of which were, or almost all of which, were buried so deeply that the thinker himself was not aware of his own assumptions. One of Strauss's familiar sayings, which I like to quote, was that, and which illustrates the complete difference between Strauss and almost everybody else, was that any intelligent American had more in common with Socrates than Socrates had in common with any stupid Athenian. In other words, being intelligent was more important than being an American or an Athenian, that there were truths outside of history and time and outside of particular societies. And these truths were the ultimate concern of philosophy, including political philosophy. So one could, in studying political philosophy, one was seeking to find out what were the ultimate answers to the ultimate questions.
One example that you give in your book, New Birth of Freedom, is that you were struck by the notion that the debate between Lincoln and Douglas was precisely the same debate that took place between Thrasymachus and Socrates in the first book of Plato's Republic. Is that an example of the non-historicist reading
Absolutely.
Of a text?
The debate between Socrates and Thrasymachus in the first book of the Republic arose out of Thrasymachus' definition of justice as the interest of the stronger. And what Thrasymachus had meant by this is that in a tyranny, justice is what the tyrant says. In an oligarchy, justice is what the rich say. In a democracy, it's what the poor say, or the majority of the poor say. Douglas's, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Douglas's, the real subject was Douglas's theory of popular sovereignty. And Douglas said that the question of slavery in the territory should be decided, as all questions should be decided, by the majority, see. The people spoke when the majority was discovered through a popular election. So Douglass's definition of justice in a democracy was the same as Thrasymachus. Of course, Thrasymachus also would say that justice was, in a different society, would be different. But in a democracy, Thrasymachus said, justice is what the people want, and that's exactly what Douglass said. Lincoln, like Socrates, denied that. But the fact that the issue between Lincoln and Douglass and that of Socrates and Thrasymachus was the same issue shows the fact that this is a universal question which transcends time and place. 19th century America, 5th century BC Athens, and the same question involved the same alternatives. So political philosophy was is the master science for discussing what is the ultimate core, what is the ultimate purpose of public policy, and whether or not there are not principles of justice which transcend time and place.
Strauss's approach to the text was one of elucidating the permanent human questions, a non-historical approach to the human questions and the questions of natural right.
And that was Strauss's is famous for his so-called esoteric interpretations. Well, the reason for esotericism is that the in any particular time and place, discussions are conducted in the idiom of that time and place, but great writers transcend that idiom, and so when reading a text, one had to distinguish between those things which are, you might say, concessions to the conventional wisdom of the time, as distinct from the real arguments which were independent of time. I was able to, in my discussions of Lincoln, particularly my interpretation of Lincoln in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, when Lincoln would say things like, "I am not now and never have been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes or permitting to marry with white people," I pointed out that he said, "I am not now and never have been." He didn't say what he would be. Lincoln had to make concessions to public opinion in order to be an active politician. He couldn't change the prejudices of his audience as a way of condition of speaking to them. Well, that I learned from Strauss, you see. Many people think that Strauss was just an exegete who was absorbed by the hermeneutics of interpretation. But Strauss was always interested in interpretation as a vehicle to have access to the fundamental questions and the fundamental responses to those questions. And for him, that was philosophy.
One commentator has written that all of Strauss's work was done in the context of the crisis of the West, and that you have written in the context of the crisis of America, mm-hmm. but that you say that the crisis of the West is identical with the crisis of America. Is that an accurate comment?
Yes.
Would you care to elaborate?
Yes. Well, Strauss, what the crisis of the West is the crisis of that civilization which was born by in Jerusalem and Athens, and was the coming together of reason and revelation emanating from Jerusalem and Athens that formed the core of Western civilization. Medieval philosophy, which is where Strauss sort of got it, was his starting point, was the point where the debate between reason and revelation had its most acute and intelligible form. My first book, as you know, was on Thomas Aquinas, Commentary on Aristotle's Ethics. And I besides reading the commentary, I don't know that I read every page, every one of the questions in the Summa Theologica, but I certainly read most of them. And in those days, I read them in Latin, too. Thomas's definition of the natural law was the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. And the eternal law was the law by which God ruled the entire universe. That meant that people through reason could participate in God's government of the universe, which was certainly a government which had its roots outside of time and place. Writers like Thomas Aquinas, like Aristotle, who was his master as far as the wisdom of this world is concerned. It was assumed, of course, that human reason actually knew the things that it spoke about. The modern philosophy had collapsed the basis for philosophy and for theology by denying the power of the human mind to climb the ladder of truth from the things that are known to us to the things that are known that are intelligible in themselves.
So modern philosophy was an attack both on reason and revelation?
Yes. Socratic skepticism And the word skeptis, as you know, skeptomai in Greek means to inquire. But of course, you only inquire into those things that you don't know. If you know something, you don't have to inquire about it. But if you don't know, you have to inquire. So Socratic skepticism was an inquiry into the questions that we need to know an answer to, such as what is virtue, what is happiness, what is human life, what is the purpose of human life. The assumption was that we had knowledge of the external world from which we really knew, but which we didn't know well enough. We had to ascend from the distinctions which are given to us in ordinary sense perception and experience. The first chapter of Hobbes' Leviathan is the denial that sense perception gives us any access to the external world. And that premise underlies all modern philosophy. That cut the ground out from Socratic skepticism, which was also, in a way, the foundation of faith as well as of reason.
So Hobbes's response and the response of modernity generally was to attack both the possibility of revelation and the possibility of reason.
Right. We have had now 400 or 500 years of the development of that response, and the result is that reason and revelation are both discredited, and we find the churches, all different kinds of churches, finding their master in Heidegger in the existentialist response, which is the response of will undirected by reason. This is the crisis of the West, as Strauss articulated it. I discovered that the crisis of the West, the way in which it most directly affects us, and the form in which it is most accessible to us, that the crisis is in the crisis in the American political tradition, arising from the essentially the misinterpretation or the simple rejection of the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence actually combines, I think, on the highest, well, certainly political level, and maybe even in the highest philosophical level, that form of Western civilization which preserves both reason and revelation in their ability to instruct human life. And since the United States has become the preeminent, not merely power in the world, but the preservation of Western civilization is now the responsibility of the United States above all others. So the loss of the sense of ultimate purpose in American political civilization carries with it the threat of the destruction of Western civilization altogether.
Strauss had written that the conflict between reason and revelation really was the secret vitality of the West.
Yes.
And that there was a kind of dialectic in the West that required keeping alive the dispute between reason and revelation.
There are two different reactions to that. One is the emphasis on the difference, but there is also the emphasis he placed on the agreement that the morality of Socratic skepticism and the morality of biblical morality were, if not identical, yet very nearly identical. The crisis in the West today is a crisis over the moral foundations of constitutional government. It is the denial in the highest and most respectable circles of Western civilization that there is any objective moral basis for constitutional government in which the crisis of our time finds its greatest expression. And I'll repeat the lines which I have repeated ad nauseum now from Justice William Rehnquist in his famous essay on the notion of a living constitution, when he says that if a people adopts a constitution with safeguards for individual liberty, these do indeed take on a certain moral rightness and goodness. They do so neither because of any intrinsic worth or any ideas of natural justice, but only because they have been adopted by a people. Now, the denial that that safeguards for individual liberty do not have any intrinsic worth means that individual liberty does not have any intrinsic worth. But it means something more. It means that when he speaks of these safeguards taking on a certain moral rightness or goodness, that means that they do not take on any real moral rightness or goodness. This is only the illusion of moral. But so the illusion of virtue is the only access we have to virtue. Now, another aspect of Mr. Rehnquist's dictum is that the Constitution of 1787, whose original intent he presumably was celebrating, had great safeguards for slavery. But the safeguards for individual liberty and the safeguards for slavery were adopted by the same people at the same time, which means the safeguards for slavery took on a moral rightness or goodness identical to the safeguards for individual liberty. That means that he was basically stating the thesis of Calhoun in the South in 1861.
Someone has written that the bulk of your career has been the attempt to uncover and articulate the natural right foundations of the American founding. And this has centered on your explication of the Declaration of Independence and Lincoln's interpretation of the Declaration of Independence. Many of your critics have said that you place too much weight on the Declaration of Independence, that after all, the Declaration is an expression of modern philosophy. It's a radical, modern expression of the supremacy of rights over duties and liberty over community. How do you respond to these critics? And I have particularly in mind here Robert Bork and his book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah.
Leo Strauss has written that one should give unhesitating loyalty to decent constitutions in modernity. And certainly he had in mind principally the American Constitution. But he said these constitutions needed support from classical political philosophy. They couldn't be defended and supported merely on the basis of modern philosophy. Now, when Strauss said that, I'm not sure that he looked upon the Declaration as the vehicle for classical philosophy, but that is what I have come to conclude. However, in Crisis of the House Divided, I think I demonstrated, even to Strauss's satisfaction, that Lincoln, while using the language of the Declaration of Independence, had in fact implemented classical principles of natural right. Since I wrote Crisis, I have concluded that Lincoln was not original in doing this, that the foundations for his use of classical, a prudent use of classical natural right, was in fact in the founding itself. And I think that it actually is in the Declaration of Independence itself, although I didn't see it 40 or 45 years ago, nor did Strauss. But the Declaration says, goes from we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government which to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. So the rights, the point is that what is our rights in the first instance become ends in the second, and the ends are then subsumed under the phrase safety and happiness. Safety and happiness are the alpha and omega of political life in Aristotle's Politics. So the Declaration transforms itself from a merely Lockean or supposedly Lockean doctrine of rights into one of ends, which implies duties. And those ends are the ends of the classical politeia.
Why the emphasis on rights in the Declaration of Independence and barely a mention or only an implication of the duties that are correspondent to those rights?
Well, the explanation of that and the explanation of how I have come to the paradoxical conclusion, that may be, that the Locke of the Founding Fathers is really Aristotle in disguise, because Aristotle in 1670 or whenever it was that Locke wrote the second treatise was writing a handbook for legislators, just as the politics was a handbook for legislators in the ancient world. So the second treatise was a handbook for legislators in the modern world. But that the universe within which political philosophy found itself was one dominated by Christian monotheism. It was fundamental for, at least from a practical standpoint, Plato and Aristotle never discussed the question of political obligation, which is the theme of the Declaration. The Declaration says why we are obligated to obey laws under certain circumstances and have a right to disobey laws under another. That question didn't arise for Plato and Aristotle because the ancient city was always looked upon as a creation of the gods of the city. And the question of why I should obey the law for Plato and Aristotle was answered for non-philosophic men by the statement that that these laws came from God. In fact, if one reads the Old Testament as a document of the ancient city, one sees there that a kind of paradigm. When we look at the Bible, we think of, well, children of Israel, they're chosen by God to bring the message of the biblical message to all mankind. But the laws of Moses in their origin were the laws of a particular people, and the God of Israel was their God. And this relationship between man, God, and law, which we find in the Old Testament, was typical of almost every ancient city. That relationship is changed by Christianity. I say Christianity because it never really changed for Judaism or Islam, but for Christianity, the Christian God is not a legislating God. He doesn't lay down laws for particular people. He lays down principles for all people, but there is no particular legislation there's no municipal legislation for the Christian God. However, the Christianity established a kind of universal community of all believers, and every human being looked at from the point of view of the Christian Middle Ages or Christianity simply was a actual or potential citizen of the city of God, and one's membership in the city of God took precedence over one's membership in a particular national or municipal community. And that's why religious liberty is the first liberty, the one which cannot be compromised by any municipal legislation.
Some students of Strauss argue that Strauss had proven that Machiavelli had destroyed the possibility of classical natural right, and that modern natural right, which took its place, was a considerably lower and perhaps even a vicious version of natural right. But you're now saying that classic natural right, Aristotle, was transmitted to the founders through Locke. Isn't this something of a new interpretation? And doesn't this go against Strauss's own interpretation of Locke?
I haven't reconsidered Strauss's interpretation to the point of seeing that it was necessarily different from what mine is. But I think that my critics, at least, confuse or confound Strauss's interpretation of Locke in this, in Natural Right and History with his interpretation, or the interpretation of the Lockeanism of the founders. They, I think, clearly read Locke in a way consistent with classical political philosophy. Just as an example, I mentioned, of course, the transformation within the Declaration of Independence from a merely Lockean to an Aristotelian form. But George Washington, in his first inaugural address, gave a wonderful statement. He said the foundations of public policy will be laid in the immutable principles of private morality. The private morality is the foundation of public policy. For there is no truth more firmly established in the entire economy of nature than the indissoluble union of virtue and happiness. Now, that is the best short statement of the teaching of the Nicomachean Ethics. And in virtue, so the pursuit of happiness, as Washington interpreted it, was the pursuit of virtue. Now, that certainly doesn't make rights more fundamental than duties.
You've described New Birth and Freedom as somehow a second sailing, that you have revised and I think deepened your understanding of the American founding. But you have revised your opinion of the character of the American founding. Before, you believed it was the modern Locke, the radically modern Locke that had informed the founding, and Lincoln had made essentially a refounding of the regime.
Yes.
You don't hold that opinion anymore.
The opinion I had in 1959 or 58 when I finished, and that is, it's mostly incorporated in, I think, the 14th chapter of Crisis. I think the title is The Universal Meaning of Equality, where I systematically distinguish Lincoln's understanding of the Declaration from the, might say, the modern Lockean, and I gave him credit for elevating the founding to a level of to the level of classical political thought, and I now think that the foundation for Lincoln's Aristotelian interpretation of the principles of natural rights was the example of the Declaration. And of Washington.
So now you believe that what Lincoln was doing in the Civil War crisis was a perpetuation of the founding rather than a refounding.
Both things are true. That is to say, recently the current Pope gave this wonderful speech on the American founding when he welcomed Lindy Boggs as the Vatican ambassador. The Pope, after celebrating the moral realism of the self-evident truths of the Declaration, which he endorsed as representing true morality, said every generation must renew this. And he ended his speech by calling for a new birth of freedom. And so I think that every generation must rediscover in its own soul the principles of the founding, for the founding to be a perpetual accompaniment of constitutional morality. You know, the citizens must be constantly re-educated.
Some people have argued that the principles of the Declaration of Independence are incompatible with Christianity because the Declaration is the product of the natural rights philosophy, the modern philosophy of natural rights, and somehow that philosophy stemming from Hobbes or Locke and Rousseau excludes religion or faith as the possibility of faith.
It's important to understand that Christian monotheism, by making one's duty to God independent of the polity, made a duty prior that laid down the foundation of a duty as prior to any rights, and the rights which were mentioned by the Declaration of Independence, by the way, are rights with which we are endowed by our Creator, which means, of course, that the exercise of those rights is understood to be necessarily consistent with the purpose that is assigned to the Creator in making that endowment.
Yes, but the Declaration refers to nature's God, not the biblical God.
God appears in a variety of guises in the Declaration. Four altogether. Nature's God, Creator, which means, implies, I think, that the Creator is the creator of nature, and that God appears as a functionary within the laws of nature on the basis of a creation. Then, of course, there is the supreme judge of the world, who to whom the Declaration appeals for the rectitude of their intention. And then finally, there is the divine providence. So God appears as legislator, judge, and chief executive. But behind all of those, behind that trinity, there is the Creator, I think. The rights with which we have been endowed by our Creator are rights which presumably reflect the intention of the Creator. And so that's why the exercise of rights are not, for example, the right of revolution, which certainly comes from the Declaration, the right to alter or abolish is the right of revolution. The right of revolution is not something that may be exercised at the pleasure of anybody individually or collectively. It's a right which can only be exercised either to establish a regime where these rights are recognized, or to prevent the overthrow of a regime where these rights are recognized.
You've said that social compact is the heart of the American Revolution. Is this the ground and foundation of obligations in the theory of the Declaration of Independence?
Yes. Madison repeatedly speaks about compact, uses the word compact as the basis of all free societies. Well, what does compact mean? What it means is that since all men are created equal in their rights, see, that therefore society doesn't arise directly from nature. I mean, authority does not arise. For example, the authority of a man over a dog is determined by the difference between the nature of the man and the nature of the dog. But there is no difference in nature among human beings that would make one the ruler of another by nature. Therefore, political society and political authority arises from consent or compact. There must be a social compact or an agreement among each one of the constituent members of a political society that they agree to be governed by certain laws for the common good. And in these laws there can be no discrimination among the members of society as to who is to benefit more or who is to pay more for the society.
So the original compact in America is the Declaration of Independence.
Well, the proposition that all men are created equal is,
yes,
is not the Declaration as such, because the various states were formed into societies before the Declaration. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had the authority to make the Declaration.
You've said that the crisis of the West is identical to the crisis of America in 1859 and 1860. Yeah. What precisely did you mean by that?
Well, having recourse now to 59 or 60, 61, the crisis of the Union came because the South, instructed largely by John C. Calhoun, but assisted by others, said that the Constitution was a compact in which the signatories or the participants, those who ratified the Constitution, were partners in an enterprise in which no discrimination could be made between the domestic institutions in one state and the domestic institutions in another. The Republican Party came to power in 1860 by declaring that the territorial question had to be resolved by the Fifth Amendment, guaranteeing the the life, liberty, and property of each human individual, each person. It doesn't say citizen. It says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property. And that, therefore, no black person any more than any white person could be held in slavery in a federal territory. Federal territories were under the sovereignty of the United States. Not they did not have state sovereignty because they had not yet become states. And therefore, the Fifth Amendment really meant that slavery could not be extended to any federal territory. The South replied to that by saying that the slaves were regarded as property, and the Fifth Amendment said that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property. So the question was, did a Negro who had been a slave in a federal territory, did the Constitution protect his liberty, or did it protect the property of the man who had owned him? And there was no way of resolving that difference through the text of the Fifth Amendment or any other part of the Constitution. Lincoln agreed it had to be done through the but he said that the Congress had a duty to outlaw slavery in the territories because slavery was inconsistent with the principles of constitutional government, which again takes us back to the Declaration of Independence. But the South said that any condemnation of slavery, any political condemnation of slavery, was a breach of the Constitution, because the Constitution was made possible only by an agreement to differ over the question of slavery in 1787, and that by demanding that the policy of the federal government be based upon the moral condemnation of the institution of slavery as it was in the slave states simply violated the idea of a citizenship common to the North and the South. So their position was that the very election of Lincoln was a violation of the Constitution because it was a violation of the agreement, which the compromise which was made, which compromised itself, assumed the character of a moral principle.
So at the heart of the crisis of 1859-60 was the rejection of the principles of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
And how is that also at the heart of the crisis of the West today?
If one looks at the literature of constitutional controversy, one finds two main camps arrayed against each other. Those who believe that the Constitution is so-called living constitution, the faction presided over largely by the late Justice Brennan and Thurgood Marshall, but including the one who wrote the Roe v. Wade, that's Harry
Blackmun.
Yes, the whole line of cases decided by the principles of what today called liberal jurisprudence is based upon the notion that the original intent of the framers of the Constitution is a bygone age reflecting bygone problems, and there must be, for the Constitution to be a living organism, it must adapt itself to the problems of this age. And what has, as you know, what has happened repeatedly is that the substantive due process in the form of people litigating causes based upon the claim that they have been deprived of some right, and therefore the court can invent any right you want and get a remedy for that right. There's no limitation upon the judicial power arising from the text of the Constitution, which becomes perfectly flexible. Now, the conservatives who are opposed to this say, no, we must be bound by the text, and which means we are bound by the original intent of those who drafted and those who ratified the Constitution. But the conservatives are always losing, for the very simple reason that the conception of original intent subscribed to by Rehnquist and Bork and Scalia and others does not really address the question. It simply is false to the history of the Constitution, And what they call original intent is simply legal positivism.
Because they view the Constitution as merely a process for making decisions without any end or purpose or goal.
That's exactly.
Yes. Lincoln succeeded in restoring the principles of the Declaration of Independence to the regime. But his success seems to have been very short-lived. And that
very short-lived,
and that success was overwhelmed in short order by the what you've called the forces of historicism and mm-hmm. positivism. Mm-hmm. Indeed, you say perhaps even nihilism. Could you explain precisely how that happened?
In my book, in the second chapter of my recent book, I subjected the Carl Becker's book on the Declaration of Independence to analysis. And Becker's book, which I think is still the best book ever written on the subject, in beautiful prose, with a great deal of sympathy. But Becker, in the last chapter of the book, says to ask whether the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence is true or false is essentially a meaningless question. That means to ask whether or not the principle that all men are created equal and the morality goes with that, ask whether that is true, is essentially meaningless. Now, if that is meaningless, then the question of whether the Union cause were just or unjust is meaningless. Because the Lincoln's judgment on the question of the morality of slavery and the right to the defense of the Union depended upon the meaningfulness of the principles of the Declaration. So why was it that Becker, I used him as an example because he was the president of the American Historical Association. He was widely recognized as one of the great Ivy League senior professors who embodied the thought of the establishment, of the establishment of the progressive era on the highest level of dignity in our society. And Becker dismissed the principle of the Declaration because history had replaced nature as the basis of political judgment. Now, Becker assumed that this was true. There's no argument as to why history was better than nature. But Becker believed in the idea of progress, as the progressive era did. He believed that since the historical school came after the natural rights school, that the historical school was wiser and better. And particularly when evolution was added to Hegel's historicism, he thought that had shown once and for all that the theory of human beings and the science of nature and the science of human affairs was one and the same science because they could all be subsumed under the idea of evolution.
Strauss in Natural Right and History wrote that rejection of natural right is nihilism or identical to nihilism.
Yes.
So historicism and positivism are insofar as they reject natural right are steps on the way to nihilism.
Earlier when I said that William Rentke said that safeguards for individual liberty did not have any intrinsic worth, that meant that human liberty had no intrinsic worth. It meant that human life had no intrinsic worth. And one of Rehnquist, or maybe his greatest hero, was Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who in the grip of the evolutionary enlightenment said once that human life had no more meaning than a grain of sand. So that's nihilism.
For Strauss, the crisis of the West was the rejection of the possibility of natural right as the basis for political order and morality.
And the unwinding of that story is the story of the crisis of the West.
Someone has said that your book, Crisis of the House Divided, was the first pro-Lincoln book ever written. Could that possibly be true?
Well, I said it. It's got to be true.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant when I first read the Lincoln-Douglas debate, it was almost on a odd chance I was in the Fourth Avenue bookstore in New York and picked it up and read some of it and came back the next day and read some more. And finally, I did something I very seldom did in those days. I bought it. since we were living on, what, $35 a week or something. And after I read it through the debates and two or three times, I thought I'd look and see what had been written about it in the historical literature. And I found out, for example, that Albert J. Beveridge, who was really, in a sense, the first modern scholarly biography of Lincoln, although he was a United States Senator from Indiana, he had said it really wasn't worth anybody's while to read them. And he really sounded a note which no one really contradicted. And there was nothing in the historical literature that said more about the debates than that they brought Lincoln to national prominence and therefore was a part of was a vehicle in his rise to power into the presidency.
But in your interpretation of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, you saw that debate as somehow revealing the very soul of the American polity.
Absolutely, yes. Because the question of the extension, I mean, the political question which the country faced was limited to the status of slavery in the territories. But one must bear in mind that the Mexican War added 40% of the land, increased the land area of the United States by 40%. It decreased the land area of Mexico by 60%.
Yes.
But if you add both Texas to California, it might even have been more than that. So there was a vast area to be settled and to be organized into political communities called states. And at some point, if there were to be no more slave states, then at some point, three-fourths of the states might have been free states, and in theory, at least, slavery might have been abolished by constitutional amendment. That's not a likely outcome, but certainly a process would have been set in motion which would have pointed towards the ultimate extinction of slavery, which is what Lincoln thought.
Yes.
And he,
yep.
Of course, his expectation this would be done by the states, not through federal action.
What did Lincoln mean when he said that the Constitution had put slavery on the road to ultimate extinction?
He thought that the founders had written a constitution which would certainly give the federal government power to somehow deal with other questions as well as slavery in a way that the government under the Articles of Confederation could not possibly. Remember that under the Articles there was no executive, there was no judicial system. Congress was really a kind of League of Nations in terms of its powers.
Did he mean that the founding principles had put slavery, had condemned slavery, or that slavery was incompatible with the founding principles, mm-hmm. and that it was only a matter of time before political practice conformed to the principles?
I might say one of the best interpretations of the founding, and in a way peculiarly authoritative, was Alexander Stevens' Cornerstone speech. When Stevens said that the founding generation was committed to the idea of racial equality. No question about that. As to the existing institution, he said they didn't know exactly what to do about it, but they were confident that in the process of time, slavery would disappear. However, we now, Stevens speaking in 1861, said we know that they were wrong. Science has discovered in the meantime that Negroes are inferior to whites, and that it is best for both races that they be slaves, you see. But there was no question as to what had been the founding. Now, the expectations of the founders were confounded by two developments. The development symbolized by the invention of the cotton gin, mm-hmm. which combined with the power loom and the steam engine, sparked the Industrial Revolution. And made slave labor much more valuable than it had been and that they expected it to be. So there was a tremendous increased demand for slaves. But the other thing that happened, which I think in the long run was more important, we've already been talking about it, was the substitution of history for nature in the predominant forms of European thought, which became the predominant forms of American thought.
What do you think future scholarship will hold for Lincoln, and what will his reputation be in the immediate and long-term future?
Well, I said that I believe that crisis was the first real defense of Lincoln. Now, what the future will hold is hard to say. The public has the, by and large, the American people think that Lincoln was a great man and he stood for great things. When they recite the Gettysburg Address, as the Governor Patakic did at the end of the ceremonies marking 9/11 at Ground Zero, there was hardly a person who was there or who listened to it who was not even in tears, who was not in tears over the pathos of that. I wrote something on that subject some time ago, which I'd like to read, which may serve as a peroration here. The utterances that have come down to us, graven in bronze and in stone, like the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural, are profound meditations on human experience. In the midst of the horrors of destruction and death, and amid the turmoil of the passions of war, they are designed to reconcile us to our fate by discerning the hand of God in events that might otherwise seem merely chaotic. Although these speeches arise out of particular events at particular times, they draw back the curtain of eternity and allow us as time-bound mortals to glimpse a divine purpose within a sorrow-filled present and tell us how our lives, however brief, can nonetheless serve a deathless end. Now, I think that those lines, in a way, articulate the feeling that most Americans have in reading the Second Inaugural or the Gettysburg Address. But of course, that depends upon taking seriously the difference between time and eternity. Yeah. And the responsibility that we have in our own lives to participate in something that is not merely time-bound, but that can be eternal.